Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Paul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're here to shine a light on some surprising and inspiring places and what we can learn from them.
Where to be a woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday, the 22nd of March, these are our main stories. Large areas of Ukraine are suffering blackouts after Russian missiles targeted energy infrastructure. The UN Security Council has failed to adopt a draft US resolution calling for an immediate and sustained ceasefire in Gaza. After weeks of political unrest, Senegal prepares for Sunday's presidential election. Also in this podcast.
By taking a simple blood test, we've shown that we can get the results of the molecular analysis back within 2 weeks. And that, of course, is really important if you've got something like lung cancer, which can grow quite quickly.
The test being offered to lung cancer patients in England that can identify whether they can be treated with tablets instead of chemotherapy. There's been a big new wave of Russian missile and drone attacks in Ukraine. They've particularly targeted the country's critical infrastructure, like power plants. Up to 1 million people have been left without electricity so far. At least one missile hit a major hydroelectric dam on the Dnipro River at Zaporizhia. Valentina lives right by it.
We saw everything because our windows overlook the dam. I woke up at 4 a.m. thinking it was just thunder. Then I realised it wasn't thunder. At 4:30, all hell broke loose. There were terrible fireworks and explosions. At one point, our tall high-rise house tilted. There were 2 huge fireballs where the dam is, and several explosions, one after the other. Then it all went quiet, and only the fires were burning. And then, half an hour later, it all began again.
Thursday night's attacks follow several days of Russian bombardments of Ukrainian border towns and villages. Hundreds of frail and elderly people have been helped to move further into the country for their own safety. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports from Sumy near the Russian border.
Nina Skorkina has just lost everything she owns, and her daughter can't comfort her. When Russian planes first bombed her village, the 87-year-old refused to leave. Then the police rescue teams came for her. The elderly were evacuated under fire, with officers urging them on and out of danger. The most frail were carried on stretchers made of blankets, rushed over bridges already bombed. This is all happening in the Sumy region in northeastern Ukraine, right on the Russian border. The police video captures images of whole streets there, destroyed by airstrikes, in a sharp escalation in attacks. When I visit a temporary shelter for the evacuees, the first thing I hear is a plea for help for Ukraine soldiers. Anything to push the Russians back. The next outburst is of anger at Vladimir Putin, who launched this war and just secured himself another 6 years in the Kremlin. This is Tatiana.
Putin is our enemy. What did he come here for? We never touched him.
But Vladimir Putin has vowed to go on with his war. And in Sumy, that means more busloads of elderly villagers who've lost everything.
This is the latest evacuation of people from villages that are under fire, close to the Russian border, being brought here for safety. More Ukrainians who've had their lives turned upside down by this war.
Those on board are confused as well as scared. One lady has brought a pot of homemade jam with her and little more. She tells me she used to go shopping in Russia just across the border. Now, Russia's military has destroyed her home. But up in Sumy, it's not only the fighting that people are fleeing. The families wheeling their cases into a reception centre have escaped occupation, a life under Vladimir Putin's rule. Zoya and her husband travelled 3 days to reach here from Kherson and a village that's now full of Russian soldiers. Zoya tells me she's left Kherson because life under Russian control crushed her spirit. For 2 years, she's been pressured to deny her identity, to take a Russian passport, even to vote for the man who ordered the invasion of her country. So I ask how it feels to be in Ukraine again.
As we were driving here, I started to cry. I breathed in the fresh Ukrainian air. Yes, we are Ukrainians.
Zoya, ending that report by Sarah Rainsford. The UN Security Council in New York has failed to adopt a draft resolution calling for an immediate and sustained ceasefire in Gaza. The measure had marked a change of policy for Washington, which had previously blocked calls for a permanent truce. But the text was vetoed by Russia and China. The US ambassador, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said the measure was desperately needed.
Every day without a deal, meaning every day without a ceasefire, leads to more needless suffering. For more than 100 hostages, including a one-year-old child being held in captivity by Hamas and other groups, for innocent Palestinians in Gaza who have been displaced, who are starving, who desperately need peace.
But ahead of the vote, the Russian ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, urged members of the Security Council not to support the draft, saying it sent the wrong signal.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you do this, you will cover yourselves in disgrace. Consider once again, how will you look before the population in the Middle East, in front of your own populations, if you support this hypocritical initiative?
My colleague Paul Henley has been speaking to our UN correspondent Neda Torfik in New York.
I think based on past resolutions, Russia and China were very clear that they wanted to see an immediate ceasefire and nothing less. Remember, past resolutions looked at various languages, calling for a pause in the fighting, creating conditions for a sustainable ceasefire. And the language in this U.S. draft resolution was very carefully worded. It did suggest that an immediate and sustained ceasefire would come as a part of the hostage deal. It directly tied an immediate and sustained ceasefire to that hostage deal being negotiated by the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar. And so what we heard in the council from Russia and China, but also Guyana, which abstained, was they felt, given how dire the situation is in Gaza at the moment and the death toll of over 32,000 civilians killed in Israel's military campaign there, that the Security Council should be calling for an immediate ceasefire without any conditions at all. They also expressed concern that the draft resolution, while it did emphasize concern about a ground offensive in Rafah, it didn't clearly and unequivocally oppose it. So there were a few points there, I think, that made many expect this veto by Russia and China on this U.S. draft. And what they have said is that if the United States is serious about a ceasefire, it should vote for a rival draft that's been put forward by the elected 7 members of the council, which demands an immediate ceasefire, calls for the unconditional release of hostages, and also calls for more humanitarian access.
Have you heard reaction from the Israeli ambassador to the U.N.?
Both the Israeli ambassador and the Palestinian ambassador are in the council, so we will be hearing from them. At the moment, Switzerland is speaking as they first go through the various members of the Security Council, but we will be able to hear reaction a bit later.
Neda Torfik. Chemotherapy is a key part of many cancer treatments, but the side effects like nausea and hair loss can be hugely debilitating and hard to live with. Now, a new blood test being tried out here in the UK for people with lung cancer may mean doing away with chemotherapy altogether. The test can show if they would benefit from treatment in tablet form instead and promises a result within 2 weeks. Professor Peter Johnson is a clinical director for cancer at the UK's National Health Service.
The way we do this is we take a small blood sample and we look for fragments of DNA which have been shed by the cancer as it's growing into the bloodstream. And we can look at the genetic makeup of that, and we can look at the molecular abnormalities that have taken place as the cancers develop. When somebody has an X-ray or a CT scan which shows something on it that looks like a lung cancer, we have to arrange for them to usually have a bronchoscopy, that's a look down into the airways, to take tissue samples from that, which we then send off to the laboratory. Those have to be processed and analysed. We have to look at the molecular changes in those, all of which, of course, is complicated to organise and takes time. By taking a simple blood test, we've shown that we can get the results of the molecular analysis back within 2 weeks. And that, of course, is really important if you've got something like lung cancer, which can grow quite quickly.
So how big an impact could this have? Fergus Walsh is our medical editor.
2,000 patients with suspected lung cancer have already benefited from the test so far. And in the coming year, a further 10,000 patients will be given the test. And what the test can do is it can find out and detect whether there are genetic mutations in the tumour which are driving cancer growth and will respond to targeted drugs in tablet form. And these are often very effective at shrinking tumours more effectively than often standard chemotherapy and have fewer side effects. It's really a game changer for many of these patients who I've spoken to. And this is the first time that these blood tests have been put into standard treatment for the diagnosis of cancer. It's still a pilot, but it's definitely the direction of travel we're seeing. And I think ultimately we'll see it spread to other tumour types for the diagnosis, say, of breast cancer and in childhood cancers.
Fergus Walsh. Malaysia says it's turned down an offer to host the 2026 Commonwealth Games because of the cost. The decision puts the event in doubt. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Mickey Bristow, reports.
Malaysia was asked to hold a sporting event after the Australian state of Victoria withdrew its offer, but it's decided it would be too expensive to host the Games, despite being promised more than $100 million by the Commonwealth Games Federation. It's not clear who, if anyone, will now host the next event in 2 years' time. Some are also questioning the point of the Games because of their colonial origins. The countries that take part all have links to the former British Empire.
Mickey Bristow. Now for a bit of escapism. The unmistakable music from the film The Great Escape, starring Steve McQueen. The film which captured one of the most famous stories about British prisoners of war. It is the 80th anniversary this weekend of the breakout by 76 men from a German prisoner of war camp. 50 of them were killed and most of the rest recaptured. But were they betrayed? When Lieutenant Desmond Plunkett, the mapmaker in The Escape, was liberated, he filled out a questionnaire in which he told British authorities that he believed that they were brought down by their own side. Well, that document has just come to light at the National Archives in London. Will Butler is the military expert there, and he's been speaking to Martha Carney.
There's a very short passage at the end of a questionnaire, which all prisoners of war fill out, where he essentially accuses, and he uses the phrase, two Indigenous Englishmen of collaborating with the Nazi authorities around the recapture and execution of the 50 of those who were executed after the Great Escape, which, you know, it's a quite a serious allegation. It's not one that we'd ever come across before in all of the research that we'd done. So, you know, it really stood out to us when we were looking at those questionnaires.
Well, it's quite specific, isn't it, the way that he talks about there being two Indigenous Englishmen?
Yes, yeah, so you know, it seems for sure that he has people in mind in that moment. The very strange thing is, you know, that the process in which all of this happens is a lot of the liberated prisoners of war undertook these questionnaires. They filled out these questionnaires, and that was really the first stage in the process. He would have been interviewed a number of times after that as well, and again, that accusation doesn't come through in the same way thereafter. So whether there's a change of mind or you know he thinks about it a little bit differently immediately afterwards, obviously we're kind of unsure in that respect.
And looking more generally, is there any evidence that there were informants inside the prisoner of war camps?
Most certainly, you know, there's evidence across the war that, you know, the German, the Nazi authorities were putting in stooges, they were often called, if you like, individuals who, you know, were placed in prisoner of war camps for that kind of purpose, to gather intelligence, to stop escape attempts, you know, to find out any information they could. And there's absolutely evidence of that. Again, we have evidence of that in the National Archives, for example.
And tell us a little bit more about Desmond Plunkett himself. People who've watched the film over many, many years will know the character played by Donald Pleasence in the film.
Plunkett was one of the forgers, the map makers. He was a pilot, of course, and shot down in 1942. He did survive the war, obviously, but was obviously one of the escapers. And he was one of the last to be recaptured along the Austrian border. He went on to carry on his career in the Air Force after the war. He's a fascinating character. His escape is an interesting one. There's some kind of comical elements, some rather slapstick elements to his time on the run after escaping in March 1944. But, you know, certainly one of those interesting characters, and one that, you know, we've had the pleasure of researching at the National Archives as part of our exhibition as well.
That was Will Butler. Still to come in this podcast.
The smell of a baby is kind of a wonderful experience for parents. Until the babies mature and at some point become teenagers. So we decided to follow that up in a real investigation.
The real reason why your baby smells nice while your teenager does not.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. My award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, collecting letters from listeners from all over the world, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. And I'm joined by some very special guests, sharing their experiences and words of wisdom too. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Time is running out for Donald Trump. He has until next Monday to secure a $500 million fine imposed on him for lying about the value of his assets. He's appealed against the ruling and says he doesn't have enough cash to pay the fine. But there could be one potential lifeline for the former president. Saranjana Tiwari, our business reporter, explains.
Among his many businesses, Mr. Trump has Trump Media, which runs the social media platform Truth Social. Now, that's poised to become a publicly listed company with shareholders of another company called Digital World Acquisition Corp. And Digital World is set to vote later today on whether to acquire Trump Media. Now, that would give Mr. Trump a stake of at least 58% in the merged company, and that's worth more than $3 billion at Digital World's current share prices. Digital World is what's known as a SPAC. It's a type of mechanism to be able to list publicly on the New York Stock Exchange. And of course, this is an astonishing potential windfall for Mr. Trump at a very trying time for him. But there are many issues with the deal, so it's not foolproof at all.
Well, it sounds as though if it does go through, it's probably going to be enough money, though, isn't it?
It probably is. The problem is there are many red flags associated with the deal, including unresolved lawsuits from former business partners. There's also the problem that Digital World has already shelled out a lot of money to resolve other fraud charges over how the merger came to be, about $18 million in a settlement. The other issue for Mr. Trump is that he's actually not allowed to sell his shares for at least 6 months. If this company does go public, although the new company could grant him an exception, what he could get is a loan backed by the value of his shares. But many analysts say that a bank would probably lend him significantly less than the shares are worth on paper, given the potential risks of the business.
So what happens if it doesn't go through? Do the bailiffs go into Mar-a-Lago?
Well, that's the big question. There are so many legal cases that former President Trump is involved in. But he has been given this deadline until Monday to put up this money. And he's what you call, he's not exactly cash rich. He has a lot of businesses, but he doesn't have that most that cash that's really needed to try and resolve these fraud charges.
That was Suranjana Tiwari. People in Senegal go to the polls on Sunday in an election that was supposed to be held last month. But 3 weeks before the due date, President Macky Sall announced it would be delayed, a decision that sparked violent clashes between police and protesters, in which three people died. Unlike so many of its West African neighbours, Senegal has never experienced a coup, and power tends to change hands at the ballot box. But is its reputation as a beacon of democracy changing? James Copnall reports from Dakar.
Election campaigning Senegalese style. We've got a huge truck with posters all over it of Bassirou Diomaye Faye, one of the main candidates. Lots of horns and vuvuzelas blaring out. This is the Medina popular neighbourhood in Dakar. And they're here to try and convince everybody to turn out to vote on Sunday. But this is no ordinary election. Just over a month ago, there was drama in Dakar.
Ces conditions troubles pourraient gravement nuire à la crédibilité du scrutin.
This is the moment when President Macky Sall delayed the election to December, long past the end of his final term. It led to uproar. Eventually, after a court ruling and considerable domestic and international pressure, the long delay was scrapped. The vote will now take place this Sunday. All the same, for many, Senegal's solid democratic standing has taken a battering. This week, the president told the BBC he had no regrets.
What's happened during the last 3 months shows that there was an information campaign targeting Senegal and its president. There was a gap of 1 month between the initial date of the election and the election of March 24th. Just 1 month. So we still have to put into perspective the judgments we make about Senegal, its democracy and its president.
Not everyone agrees.
I think Macky Sall, he has been an active president.
This is Gilles Yabi, who runs a think tank here. He praises Macky Sall for raising Senegal's profile on the international stage over the 12 years he's been in power and for infrastructure development. But
he destroyed, to some extent, his legacy at the very end of his term because he tried clearly to exclude the opposition. And the fact that you have hundreds of people who were actually arrested during the demonstrations, and at the very end you have a president proposing himself an amnesty law. So I think that is the end of his mandate is unfortunately tarnishing his legacy.
Back at the opposition rally, they're hoping their man, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, one of the front runners, will defeat the candidate from the president's political movement, Amadou Ba. With almost 20 candidates in total, there may well be a second round. But for these opposition supporters, Senegal desperately needs change.
Today in Senegal, we need to change the political, economical, social. We want to have another prison, we can change the life of population, of Senegalese population.
We've just driven past another rally, this one for Amadou Ba, former Prime Minister, a sort of continuity candidate, I guess. You certainly know there's an election going on.
James Copnall in Senegal. Now, here's a question for you. Why do babies smell sweet and teenagers a bit stinky? Well, scientists in Germany say they can provide us with the answer. Ilona Kroy is a psychologist at Friedrich Schiller University in Jena, in Germany, and a co-author of the new research.
What is the common observation everyone probably shares who has children is that the smell of a baby is kind of a wonderful experience for parents. Until the babies, yeah, mature and at some point become teenagers, and then parents don't like the smell of their babies or of their teenagers, not anymore. So we decided to follow that up in a real investigation, not just asking the parents, but really collecting body odors of babies and of teenagers and of toddlers and of everyone in between. And what we discovered there is that the parental perception of the odor really changes, namely that the parents are not able to recognize the body odor of their teenage boy or girl any longer, and they do not prefer it any longer. And then we followed this investigation by investigating the composition of the body odors, and then we found that really the body odor composition changes around puberty, so that the quality of the body odor is altered. Yeah, there are different chemical compounds in it.
So this has nothing to do with the fact that teenagers are often, well, particularly boy teenagers, are not very good at washing. It is what is coming out of the pores of the skin.
Exactly. It is not just that the quantity would be altered or something like this. It is really what is coming out of their pores. Yes.
So, Ilona, can you talk me through the evolutionary advantages of the babies having such a pleasant, recognisable smell?
So that a baby has a very pleasant smell has something to do with bonding behavior. So if you have a pleasant smell as a baby, that means that the parents want to spend more time with you, and that increases the bonding, and the baby is, of course, very dependent on the parents. And this pleasant smell of the baby, we can also observe this when we look into the parental brain, that there are pleasant and reward areas in the parents activated by smelling this baby body odor.
And why would that not be such a desirable trait when it comes to your teenagers?
Something else comes into play here. The baby body odor is particularly pleasant, not only because I know it, but also because it's genetically related to my own body odor. But when it comes to teenagers, it's not an advisable thing to prefer, or when it comes to mate choice, it's not an advisable thing to prefer someone who is genetically very much related to you. So you have this interaction between hormones, sexual hormones, which are signaling sexual maturity, which are signaling, okay, someone would be a potential mate. And this is what happens after puberty. And the genetic compound. And that leads parents to be more repulsed by the body odor of their teenagers.
Ilona Croy there. Back in the 1970s, being a photographer to the top music stars made you a bit of a star yourself. Jill Firmanowski was one such person. She started chronicling the careers of people like Bob Marley and Pink Floyd, Amy Winehouse, and many others besides. And this month, Jill Firmanowski will receive a major award in recognition of her achievements. But as Guy Lambert reports, it wasn't obvious that she'd end up mixing in such elevated circles.
As a child, it would have been hard for Jill to imagine she'd go on to have the astonishing career in photography that she's had, growing up in southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, before moving to London at the age of 11, where Beatlemania was in full swing, and Jill found herself thrust into the heart of the frenzy.
I was slightly too young to be an apple struck because they got to do sort of errands for the road crews and things like that, buying milk and cigarettes. But I was certainly an autograph hunter. I did stand outside Abbey Road a great deal.
I remember hearing that Paul McCartney would allow apple scruffs to walk Martha, his dog, sometimes. They're very trusting of apple scruffs.
He was very generous, yeah. I mean, I took my first rock shot of him outside his house. He was and still is up for honouring the fans, if that's the right word.
The art of photography was a skill that Firmanowski had to learn quickly while studying textiles and graphic design at Central St Martin's in London. After only 2 weeks training, she had a lucky break at London's premier rock venue, the Rainbow Theatre, in 1972.
They gave you a college camera for the weekend, and I was going to the Rainbow Theatre to see the band Yes. I took this college camera with me. If I go down the stairs and come down to the auditorium, maybe they won't notice that I'm not professional with this fancy-looking camera. And that's what I did. They offered me their position as the official photographers, you know. So I actually began working at the Rainbow Theatre at the age of 18 without a salary, but with this fantastic access to all these shows that were on. I like to think it was fate.
Before long, Jill Firmanowski was shooting the biggest rock stars of the 1970s and 80s, including Led Zeppelin, Blondie and the Sex Pistols. In 1994, Firmanowski's career would take another life-changing turn when a partnership with an up-and-coming band from Manchester was born. You have this extensive relationship with Oasis. How was that born?
I had a book that I'd been trying to publish called The Moment. It was a diary from the Beatles to whatever was coming up now. And Oasis were coming up now. I went to photograph them. And then about a week later, their PR said to me, would you like to work with them? And I was like, yeah. 3 years later, I'd kind of documented this massive explosion of their talent. I feel as I did my best body of work with them.
Working with Oasis during their meteoric rise to stardom presented a number of iconic moments for Firmanowski. But while Nebworth House and Glastonbury will always stick in the memory, there was one concert that will forever be the most memorable.
For me, Main Road was even more extraordinary than Nebworth. And when they walked out on that stage with all the little houses in the background and that crowd...
Good evening, Manchester!
I still get a shiver from it now. You know, it was sort of a homecoming. It was a sort of, look what we've done, Manchester.
If it wasn't for a photo shoot with the Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts in 1992, the Oasis adventure may never have happened.
When I took that picture of Charlie, I did a little shoot with him for Q magazine. And there was that Observer competition coming up with Jane Bowne Award, and I put it into that and couldn't believe I won it.
Charlie Watts is renowned for being the most modest member of the Rolling Stones. And when the portrait of him was named the winner, he wrote to Firmanowski.
So I've got a handwritten letter from him saying, you know, congratulations on winning the photo award and everything. And then he signed it, C.R. Watts, and then in brackets, drummer Rolling Stones.
Just in case you didn't know.
Precisely.
That report was by Guy Lambert. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. And on Saturday, you can hear this week's edition of The Happy Pod with Harry Bly.
Thanks, Nick. This week, we're talking about Finland. For the seventh year in a row, it's been voted the happiest country in the world. And no, it's not just the saunas. Find out what makes Finns smile with Finland's most positive person. Also, a mountain rescue mission that went dramatically wrong when the helicopter crashed. But that didn't stop rescuers, who were all fine, saving a stranded mountaineer. And we're talking about a doorbell for fish in the Netherlands. Bear with me, it's become quite a hit online. We meet the creators. All to come in The Happy Pod with me, Harry Bly, in this podcast feed on Saturday.
And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Adrian Bargava and the producer was Rebecca Wood. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.